Hi, welcome to the Honeycomb Podcast, the podcast all about New Zealand food and drink and the people that make it happen. I'm Asher Boot, your host and owner of the ramen shop, Hillside Kitchen and Cellar, and Tinakori Bistro. Taking care of all the technical stuff is producer Steve Cochran of Rockpool Productions. In this episode, we speak to Jackie Lee Morrison of Lashings about some of the realities of being a small business owner. All right, Jackie, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, let's start from the start. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about kind of where you come from and your background in hospo before you got to New Zealand?
Yeah, cool. So probably a few people have heard this story before, but I'm originally from London. I grew up there, but I lived kind of all over the place. I kind of came from a middle upper class family, and we kind of ate out a lot and did all that sort of thing. But I went through traditional schooling and then traditional university, but I was always cooking and went and did a cookery course, but didn't really feel that I wanted to go into hospitality because I said, it's such a hard life. I don't know that I want to put myself through that. Mm. But I kept coming back to it again and again. And so eventually I was working as a freelance food writer, but I was doing some catering on the side and decided that I was really hating the writing and loving the cooking. So I put myself through culinary school and from there started working at Claridge's Hotel in London and then a bunch of sort of five-star hotels and Michelin restaurants, and I ended up as the pastry sous chef at a Michelin in central London. Mm-hmm. And then end of 2016, my husband and I got kicked out of our house in London because our landlord decided to come and move back from the Middle East, which is a very common occurrence in London. And we were in a situation where we were like, well, what are we going to do? Either we stay in London, we find somewhere else to move. And by this point, we'd lived in five houses in 4 years. So we kind of said, fuck it, and moved to New Zealand.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then came here. Couldn't find any work, couldn't get a visa, took ages for all of that stuff to come through, and had 6 months where I had no visa, no job. Visa finally came through, managed to get a part-time, actually it wasn't part-time, it was a temporary job at a French bakery in town. Somebody broke their leg, so I just covered for them. And at the same time, whilst I had been looking and couldn't find anything, I started Lashings just kind of quietly.
Yeah.
And then Lashings kicked off whilst I was still working at the bakery. And so I then was working at the bakery, had a part-time job as a nanny, and was doing Lashings. So I was kind of doing all of the things at the same time to just try to make something work. And Lashings got to a point where it was getting big enough that I needed my own space, and the shop came along. So I quit the nanny job and went full-time into Lashings from there. And so that was September 2018, yeah. I think. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was kind of, I sort of haven't really stopped for about 10 years.
Yeah. That's a big shake-up, though.
Yeah, it is.
That's massive.
Yeah, and there's a whole bunch of life stuff that's been happening as well. Like, yeah, my husband and I got married in February 2018. Mm. So we were planning the wedding. We were moving countries. We were doing all these stupid, crazy things that you shouldn't do all at once.
Yeah.
And I was just doing everything.
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit burnt out.
Yeah, I get that. Not an uncommon theme throughout people we've spoken to in this podcast. I want to touch on something here. Getting a job or applying for jobs and that. I can't remember if it was you I was speaking to or someone else who was speaking about some of your experiences in terms of, you know, getting a job and sort of getting knocked back and the reasons for that and why that sort of was happening. Do you want to go into that?
Yeah, I can talk about that. So my experience of moving to New Zealand was incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
I did not expect moving to New Zealand to be as hard as it actually was, because when you move from one English-speaking country to another, you don't really expect there to be as much cultural shock as there was. And also because my husband is a Kiwi and he's from Dunedin, it was kind of, for him, it was just coming home.
Yeah.
But for me, it was completely different and it was a whole new thing. And actually what I found when I moved here was that people just did not want to know. So it was taking forever for the visa to come through to begin with, so I couldn't even apply for anything. But then I had this CV where it has all of this great experience, and literally in London, I could walk into a kitchen and get a job.
Yeah.
And I was sending it everywhere, all over Wellington. Literally every single thing I saw, even if they didn't have an actual job advertised, I was like, here is my CV, here is my experience. And I wasn't even getting replies.
Mm.
There was one person who replied to me, and it was a little bit tricky because she was saying, you know, you've got some great experience on here, we'd love to get you in. And then the timing didn't work out. And then I just got another email being like, oh, well, you know, we're not even really looking for someone at the moment. Yeah. So we'll just keep you in mind for the future.
Yeah.
And then the only person who replied to me was the French bakery that I worked for. And they were in a pretty desperate situation. But I went in for a trial and he didn't even read my CV.
Yeah.
he said, I don't read CVs. I just see what you like when you work. And then he gave me the job and actually then knew that I could do all the stuff and I could actually run everything. And so I was actually running the pastry for him, but it was only a temporary job. So when that finished, I didn't have anything else to fall back on. And that was partially somebody told me, and I thought it was completely ridiculous. It was a friend of mine who I worked with in London, and he's back in Hawke's Bay now. He said, did you write on your CV that you speak fluent English?
Yeah.
And I said, are you fucking serious? Why would I have to write that on my CV? And he said, this is a really small country with really small attitudes, and you would be surprised at how ignorant people are.
Yeah.
And I brought this up with the guy who hired me, and he said, if you are Chinese, they will shut the door in your face without even looking at you. And I don't want to say that it was a racist attitude that kept me out of the workplace, but it could have definitely been a contributing factor.
Had an influence on
it. Because my maiden name is Lee.
Yeah.
And I think I even said on my CV, British Chinese, because that's what it always said when I was in London. And I don't think I changed that. And so if you read that, then, and you had an attitude that maybe that wasn't someone you wanted in your business, then that could have been a contributing factor. But all I know is that I was just not getting any responses. And it could also have been because my experience was quite high end. And coming to Wellington, there's not a whole lot in that bracket.
I don't know. We get CVs like that, and I look at a lot, and as opposed to having to reply and go, sorry, we can't afford you,
you know?
Or we don't have space for someone of, you know, your level within, you know, what we're offering, and that it's just like, sorry, we don't have anything available.
Yeah.
The realities of that are challenging. I think, like, I absolutely think that your name has probably had an influence. I've experienced that. Asher, people don't know where it's from at all. You know, the amount of times I've turned up to something like, oh, you're not Indian, you know, or something like that. Yeah. So it does show that's how people are thinking, you know, throughout the process, which I think is kind of ridiculous for such a multicultural country in the first place.
Yeah. And it was especially shocking to me coming from London, because London is so multicultural. And that was one of the things that was really hard about moving to New Zealand, was that moving from somewhere like London, where the population is so huge and it's so multicultural, to moving to New Zealand, where it's a much smaller country, a much smaller population. And there are a lot of people in the country who will never leave New Zealand and will never have a broader view. And that was quite an adjustment that I didn't really realize I was going to have to go through.
Yeah. Unfortunate to hear, but it's good to, you know, get that out there and get people aware of sort of what's going on and those sort
of things. It was really interesting when the Christchurch attacks happened and people were talking a lot about casual racism, because that is a part of my everyday life.
Yeah.
And it's sort of something that I don't really talk about a whole lot, but there was actually a guy who came to the market and he looked at me and he bought a coffee. He looked at me and then he looked at one of the girls who works for me, who's Filipino. And then he looked at our sourdough donuts and he said, are these dumplings? And
shit.
You kind of think, are you fucking serious? Like, it wasn't even like a casual little comment. It was, he specifically looked at me and he looked at Angela and then he asked me that question. And he was maybe in his 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when I said, no, they're donuts, he just went, oh, okay. Like
it's nothing.
Yeah, there was no thought behind that whatsoever. It's just he looked at me and thought she must be selling Asian food.
Yeah. It's incredible. It really is. I do wonder, I mean, New Zealand's got a long history of Asian food. I mean, I think I might be getting this wrong, but I'm pretty sure the first proper restaurant, so non-tavern or something like that restaurant in Dunedin, was a Chinese restaurant. And it's gone from there. But it's never really diversified into our mainstream cuisine to the extent of what I would refer to modern Australian cuisine as, or some of those sort of
and
things.
The thing that I find very strange about Asian food here is that it is very much Asian food for white people.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, without being really offensive about it. It is, you know, teriyaki chicken sushi is an abomination. It should not exist. Like, I find that so incredibly offensive.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the criteria that my husband has for sushi is how big is it?
Yeah.
And how much rice is there? Yeah. Because that's what he grew up with in Dunedin, which is a student town. Yeah. So you've got loads of rice.
Got to fill you up.
Yeah, exactly. That is your one meal for the day.
Yeah.
And that is just horrific to me.
It is. Yeah. That's crazy.
And I don't understand the fish and chip shop / Chinese restaurant thing.
Yeah.
Like, that is super weird. What is chop suey? I don't know. I don't know what this is.
Well, not only what chop suey. Chop suey goes throughout the islands in that as well. There's different versions of things. It is a mishmash and all that stuff. Hey, don't knock the Chinese smorgasbord at a fish and chip shop. Thank you very much.
I remember seeing that. I was driving through, I think I was in Hawke's Bay, and it said Chinese smorgasbord. And I was like, what the fuck is that? It is just so weird. It's very, I haven't delved into it. I find it a bit weird.
Oh, it's completely weird, but it's fantastic at the same time.
Yeah. But equally, there are some amazing places that have popped up.
Absolutely.
Like Taste of Home. Yep. The Taste of Home, hands down, one of my favorite places in Wellington. And it is literally just Tina and Steve. And it's just the two of them in there making the most amazing Chinese food.
Yeah.
And then also there's a new hot pot place that's opened on Dixon Street.
Okay.
It is called Chongqing Kitchen.
Yep.
It is amazing. Awesome. I took the staff there for our staff Christmas party, and it kind of just blew all of our minds. Yeah. And I've been back like 5 times since.
Awesome.
It is so good.
Where do you sit on authentic food?
In what sense?
Well, I hate the term authentic, but mainly because my version of authentic is people using it as a way of saying that it's good.
Mm.
I don't think authentic means good.
Mm.
I think good means good.
Mm.
You know, a replication of a dish from somewhere else being remade, probably a watered down version because of availability, ingredients and things like that. Mm-hmm. As much as it may represent where it's from, it's not the same to me as to going somewhere and enjoying something. You know, I always hate seeing this idea of, you know, Tuscan food being served in New Zealand, because it goes completely against this whole idea of regional cuisine and local produce and all that. You know, give me all those ingredients locally. It makes sense to me. But some people, you know, there's this almost religious idea of what a foot dish or food has to be authentic. When for me, it's always been about the representation of the culture, the ingredients that make sense in that context, and, you know, is representative of the people making it.
So it's an interesting question, because for me personally, there are certain things that I have problems with. And this is going to be really funny for you because you own the ramen shop. So there was a conversation that I observed a little while ago, which was a Chinese-American food writer who said, why is my voice not the authority on my culture? And instead, you have a whole bunch of Caucasian food writers who are writing about a culture that is not theirs and is perceived to be the voice of that culture.
Yeah.
So there's actually a very well-known British food writer who is considered to be the authority on Chinese food.
Yeah.
But she is a middle-class white woman.
Yeah.
And for me, I kind of feel like, especially with Asian food, there is a lot of cultural appropriation.
Yeah.
And because I am Chinese and my family are from Hong Kong, and I have mentioned this several times before in various places, but my grandmother's a celebrity chef in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
It is very offensive to me when people come in and they go, well, it doesn't matter that you have all of this history and this cultural heritage. I'm taking this one bit and I'm going to make it my thing, and I'm going to present that to the world, and this will be more accepted than everything else that you have come from. So it's a really difficult question because I believe that, like you said, authenticity and good are not the same thing. But there is a really fine line when it becomes quite offensive to the culture.
Yeah. No, that's great. It is just something that always gets me. I think it's really interesting. And it is, you know, look, I own the ramen shop, obviously alongside Tsubasa, and, you know, Tsubasa grew up in Tokyo and all that. And our whole criteria is, like, do we enjoy it?
Yeah.
You know, does it, yeah. We do all the things that are representative of how it should be done. We make our own noodles to a certain standard. We make our broth from real ingredients. You know, it doesn't come out of a box. We do all these sort of things that would be how a ramen restaurant in Japan, specifically Tokyo, yeah. would make their ramen. But we don't try to replicate that because that's almost unfair.
And the interesting thing about ramen is that ramen is the one sort of Asian food that is so widely eaten and understood yeah. across the entire world.
Yeah.
It's because of instant ramen.
Yeah.
It is something that everyone is so familiar with. Yeah. And, you know, it is the cheap student food. Mm. So everybody knows, just boil the water, stick it in, throw yeah. in your seasoning packet, bit of MSG, away you go.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And also because you actually do have a Japanese business partner, mm. it's not like you're just some random white dude who went yeah. to Japan and was like, oh, these noodles are pretty funky.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's it. It is a really interesting debate, though. I'm always fascinated to hear people's sort of thoughts on yeah. that. Yeah, authentic term.
Yeah, I get, I sometimes get people kind of mansplaining to me about my own culture,
yeah.
which is, fucked you know, up. Yeah, fucked up yeah. in so many ways.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, let's move back to Lashings.
Yeah.
So you got started 2018?
Yes.
Is that when you went into the shop?
You know, it's really tricky because, yes, I went into the shop September 2018.
Yeah.
I had been operating for about a year before that
okay.
without the shop. So we were online only.
Yeah.
We were online only. We also started doing markets, I think, around about October, November, mm-hmm. our first year, 2017. So the business officially started June 2017.
Okay.
But then I had a launch party in August 2017, mm-hmm. which is when I invited a bunch of food bloggers and food Instagrammers to come and try my product. And I've been told that's a very ballsy thing to do in New Zealand.
Yeah.
I didn't really know that because in London, that's just what you do.
Yeah.
yeah. So I had a product. I wanted to get it out to the people. So I invited the people to yeah. come and try it. And then they all talked about it a lot. And so within 2 weeks of starting the business, within 2 weeks of having that launch party, I had to start sending the brownies nationwide because there was demand
for it.
Yeah.
Do you think, given how Lashing started and still what you do and things like that, that the physical premises has been beneficial?
Yes and no, because it is incredibly hard to have retail
yeah.
generally. We have had to reframe it a little bit for ourselves to think not that we have physical premises, but that we have a kitchen that yeah. is ours. So the thing about our space is it is upstairs.
Yeah.
It is down a laneway on the corner of the building. Our actual address is on a different street yeah. to where our entrance is.
Yeah.
And so these are all of the things that we fight against. And yeah. also, I didn't really realize how much of a deterrent being up some stairs
yeah.
is, but that is a huge deterrent.
We looked at that premises.
Everyone did.
Yeah. and went, yeah, can we get people up there?
Yeah, I literally have had maybe about 20 people come into the shop yeah. and go, oh, I really like what you did. I almost took this place. I'm like, yeah, you and another 19 other people. yeah.
yeah. Yeah, I think that's really interesting with the rise of dark kitchens and things like that becoming more and more common, you know, with something that is packageable and is shippable and,
yeah.
and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, it's interesting to yeah. me whether that
the,
works.
The huge benefit of the space was that there was already a commercial kitchen that was licensed with the council to be a commercial mm-hmm. kitchen. The fact that there was retail space was an opportunity to do something a little bit different. But it wasn't the be-all and end-all for why we wanted that space. As you know from looking at it, the entranceway is very narrow.
Yep.
So we had to get my lovely rationale oven in through the windows yeah. at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Fun.
Yeah. And so if we ever leave, got to go out through the windows as well. So I told my I told my suppliers I'm going to die in the shop. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah. It's easier going down than it is up with something like that. You'd be right.
Yeah.
Social media.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you guys kill it.
Thanks.
You know, you've got a great following. You get that interaction as well.
Yeah.
And you have a real voice, a real personality that comes through with the Lashings brand. It's not only you, but it is Lashings.
Mm.
You know, you can feel that. And I'm assuming that it's not just you doing it.
It is actually just me.
It is just you?
Yeah.
Okay, because it
sounds like more people.
Well, it comes across really universal. And quite often you
yeah.
can see within business, if it is just one person, it's not as consistent it kind of changes with their moods.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's multiple people, sometimes it's a little bit confuddled as well. And, and people that do it really well have that consistency. So credit to you there. Obviously, having that food writing background and that, do you think that's really helped you with your self-marketing?
Yes, definitely. To be honest, the thing that really helped me was that before I became a food writer, I was a food blogger.
Mm.
And so I actually have a lot of friends in London who are part of this food blogging scene.
Yep.
And I got invited to a lot of PR events and this, that, and the other. So I've actually just gleaned and picked up so many things from just my life and interacting as a food blogger. To be honest, I look back on my food blogging and food writing days with a bit of shame now, because when we receive anything negative, I feel it like a shard in my heart.
Yeah.
And I feel like I am so ashamed of the things that I have said and written before, because I remember there was this little Indian restaurant. Oh, it wasn't an Indian restaurant. It was there was a little restaurant which was down this road I worked at in London. And I wrote them a pretty scathing review on my food blog because I really didn't like it.
Yeah.
And I think back on this now and think, oh my God, if I was them, no wonder they were so upset.
Yeah.
Because if somebody did that to me, and people do that to us, then that hurts so much, because all you're trying to do is put out a thing into the world that you want people to love because you love it.
Yeah.
And so then when they start to say things like, well, the ceiling tiles look like an office. Like, well, I'm sorry that I couldn't fix the ceiling tiles on a 100-year-old building because I got no money.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot. And every single negative thing does impact you so much.
Oh, huge.
And so much more than people realize, because they might just say this thing flippantly, like, I'm giving your cinnamon roll 3 out of 5. Yes, I did read that review. Yeah. Thank you, Instagram.
Yeah.
You know, like, why are you giving it 3 out of 5? Because it didn't have raisins. Who puts raisins in a cinnamon roll? I've got very strong feelings about raisins and things.
We've had a 3-star review at Hillside because we didn't serve scones. Just because they didn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, everywhere has to have scones.
Yeah, exactly.
How dare you not?
It is funny, like, people have no idea the impact of their words, and they have no idea the impact that they have on another human, and they just forget that the people behind the business are humans. So with our Instagram, it is a huge double-edged sword, because you know, we do have 5,500 followers now, which is amazing.
Yep.
And it did happen very suddenly and out the blue. And I really didn't expect it to kind of kick off as much as it did. But 5,500 followers does not mean 5,500 customers.
No.
And it also means that you've got now 5,500 people who are judging every single thing that you do.
You've got to entertain.
You have to entertain.
Yeah.
You have to have a schedule of posting, because if you don't post, they're not going to remember you.
Yeah.
Because there's so many things. People are so overloaded with things constantly. You have to. Somebody said to me at the beginning when I started that I had to stay relevant. And I'm putting that in massive quotation marks, because it was the wankiest thing that anyone has ever said to me.
Yeah.
And yet, it is also the most accurate thing that anyone has said, because in this digital age, you are constantly thinking, okay, what do I do now? What do I do for this season? How do I keep them interested? How do I keep the hype up? How do I make sure that people have something new to come for?
Mm.
Because they may come for that classic milk chocolate brownie today, but tomorrow they want the super sundae.
Yep.
The day after that, they want handmade cones, you know?
How do you feel about that? You've worked in some places in London with long histories and reputations, and there's, you know, there's certain things that can't change in those environments, as opposed to, and I know I feel it less now than when first opening restaurants. I always felt at first it was like, oh, we need to keep things up to date, and we need to change, and we need to be, you know, really going. I genuinely now look at things and go, actually, let's change a little less. Let's do what we do really, really well.
Mm.
Let's lock into who we are and get people to come for that. Whereas at first it was very much like, I want to offer this thing to get more people in, or to keep those people coming back.
Yeah.
Coming from an environment that has that history and that people keep coming just because it's Claridge's or just because it's whatever, to being still a relatively new business owner, can you talk about the difference between those two and what the environment feels like?
To be honest, whilst I think Claridge's was the best place that I ever worked, purely because you had this amazing team who supported you. You had never-ending equipment and money and ingredients. Like, I remember we used Valrhona chocolate for everything.
Yep.
Everything. Even if you're coating strawberries, we were using Valrhona chocolate. And after I left Claridge's, suddenly I had Cacao Barry and I was like, what the hell is this shit? And I remember talking to my old CDP and he was like, are we the bad guys? Are we the bad guys now? Because we're so spoiled. We just use Valrhona chocolate for everything. And coming from that, where you've experienced the best and then going to other places where you have literally experienced the worst.
Yeah.
For me personally now, the thing that I really love is I love innovation because it's very boring to do the same thing over and over and over again. And I understand that there are certain staples that you need to have on your menus that people keep coming back for. And we do have that.
Mm.
So we have the most popular brownie that we do is the classic milk chocolate.
Yeah.
And I called it the classic milk chocolate because it is a classic brownie that everyone can get on board with.
Yeah.
And it is the one that is the best seller.
Yeah.
But so we have these four staples in the range that are never going to change. And then other things are really just to keep me interested because I can't make the same thing 500 times and be passionate about it the 500th time as I was with the first time.
Mm.
I'm a much better development chef than an everyday service chef because I just get too bored.
Yeah.
But I love coming up with the new ideas and figuring out how's this going to work and what is this. I love menu development.
Mm.
So something that we were doing last year, but we haven't done it so much this year at the moment, is every kind of 2-3 months, we'd put a special on, which was completely nothing to do with brownies, but it was something that I really love or something that I really wanted to make. Like in the autumn, we did tartatin.
Yeah.
And that is something that I made every single day at the French restaurant I worked at in London. And I would make like 24 tartatin a day there. And then here I was making one tartatin for 1 week, you know?
Yes. That is a really interesting thing with chefs because they're very much as, and me and Sebastian are great examples of this. Sebastian survives, loves, dies for that, doing the same thing multiple times, exactly the same, really, really well, that sort of thing. I get itchy feet so quickly and need to do something else and want to be, you know, creative or change things and all that. And finding that balance is really tricky.
Mm.
Finding that balance in staff is really, really tricky because you want that drive, that want to develop and move forward, but you need that consistency to keep things going.
Yeah, I only have one chef working with me full time.
Mm.
And she's amazing. She actually is, she's Chinese and she had worked a little bit in a couple of other places. And she came to me because she needed some extra hours, but she's actually ended up coming on full time with me now.
Oh.
And I've just watched this girl grow over the last year. And now she is doing all the morning bake without me. She can do service. She's like my work husband. She makes me food and she just comes in with these little containers of food and she'll just put it in front of me and be like, I made this. It's like amazing stuff. And so we're actually trying to utilize the space a little bit more cleverly. So we're trying to plan monthly dinners that we're going to call Beyond Brownies. And Emily's actually going to do a Chinese banquet as one of the dinners.
Yeah. It's exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's going to be a bit different for us, but we, with the changes that have been happening recently with the underground market and stuff, we have to find ways to make money and use our space and our staff more effectively.
Yeah, underground market. I mean, that's only recently come about, obviously, due to earthquake proneness.
Mm-hmm.
That's disappearing. How big a part of your business was that?
To be honest, without the underground market, we would not be able to pay our bills weekly.
Mm.
It may not seem like much, but we do the coffee down there.
Yeah.
And we are the only people doing coffee down there. So if there's 500 people coming through and they're all buying coffee, then that floats our business, basically.
Yeah.
It is a huge loss to us. It was very unexpected. And life has been very stressful since then.
Mm. And I know the underground market are obviously actively looking for a new space. That's not going to be easy to find. So, you're doing things to look at how to recoup, you know, some of that income and keep things going. I guess that draws us into the, you know, the realities of owning a food business and the cost of making food and, you know, presenting it to people has, you know, huge challenges. It's something we've spoken about on this podcast before and we'll continue to speak about because it's something I'm passionate about, not only because I own food businesses, but just fairness and things like that. And it's the value of food versus the cost of food.
Mm.
And that empathy that I'm not sure is out there in the public domain of what it costs financially just to put a plate of food together,
yeah,
or a dining experience together. Yeah. And, you know, I said it to you earlier and you know, I'll double up on this, that I think people don't realize how often when they're eating, drinking, dining out, that the owners of that business are quite often subsidizing their meal.
Yes.
You know, yeah, in reality, it should cost significantly more,
yes,
to go out. Can you talk about the realities of being a food business owner and what it's actually like?
So I think the best way to maybe talk about this is to give you a rundown of my week.
Yep.
So we're closed Monday, Tuesday. On Monday, I do admin. I have meetings. I run around picking up all the random shit that needs to be picked up. Today, I've got back-to-back meetings from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. And I'm also running or assisting with Weli Hospa Wahine. Mm-hmm. So I do that stuff on my Monday as well. So I get up around 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, and then I just am on the go until late at night. And then tonight I'm actually going with a friend to the World Tour concert thing that's happening in Wellington because she needed a friend to go with her.
Yeah.
So I left the house this morning at 8:30, and I'm not going to be home until like 11 p.m. Tomorrow I'm in prep from 8 a.m. until about 4 p.m. And in the middle of the day, I've got a meeting, plus just generally we have to get all the stuff ready for the shop. On a Wednesday, Emily starts at 7 o'clock and she finishes around 11 or midday to do the morning bake. I am in from 9 a.m. until 7 p.m. by myself. I've got three tour groups coming through. I've got an extra staff member with me for those three tour groups. And then I've got two girls coming in from 7 p.m. until 10:30 to do the evening shift. Then on Thursday, it's exactly the same thing where I start again. Emily starts at 7, I start at 9, I finish at 7, Emily finishes at 11, two girls coming in 7 p.m. till 10:30. Friday, I start at 8 o'clock, Emily starts at 7 o'clock. We do the morning bake together because that's when we do all the market bake. I then work in the shop by myself until 5. I've got another two tour groups coming in on Friday. Then one of my girls comes in from 5 till 7 because I have to go home and be in bed by 8 o'clock. The other girls come in from 7 p.m. till 10:30. They text me the market milk, or they text me the milk count at 9 p.m. so I can order milk for the next day. I go to sleep by 9 o'clock. I get up for 4 o'clock so that I can get into the kitchen and fry the donuts. I then work on a Saturday from 4 a.m. until 7 p.m. I do the market drop-off, market pickup. I have two girls who come in into the shop in the day on Saturday to help because that's our busiest day. I've got two girls who work at the market on a Saturday. On a Sunday, I get up at 7 o'clock. I go to Moore Wilson's at 8:30, do all of the shopping for the week. Emily starts at 7 o'clock. Somebody else comes in at 9:30. They both work until 4:45. I do the market pickups, market drop-offs all day Sunday, and I'm also looking for a house. So my husband and I are going to do house hunting. We somehow managed to fit in a brunch somewhere, and that is literally the only day of the week I see my husband.
Yeah.
And then it starts all over again.
Yeah.
So that is my week.
Yeah.
And I have not paid myself since November last year because we don't have enough money in the business to hold money to pay for our 20th a month invoices, plus pay all my staff, plus pay all my suppliers. So since November, I haven't paid myself. And before that point, I was paying myself a very nominal $200 to $300 a week if we could afford it.
Yeah.
And you pay for a $5 brownie.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. I hope anyone listening to this can share this with someone else. Share it with anyone who complains about any price of food in a restaurant, cafe, wherever, because this is the reality.
Yeah.
And I really don't think people get that. They don't. They really don't. And there'll be people that turn around and go, well, that's a shit business plan then.
Yeah.
A good business plan, yeah, you'll be paying double what you currently are for food.
Yeah.
Across the board, everywhere.
The way that we have to do our costings is we look at, and also because we use premium local ingredients, we use single origin chocolate from Baron Hasselhoff, who is also a small business. Yep. We use Fix and Fog peanut butter, who they're a bigger business, but they are also still a small business.
Well, they've only become a bigger business recently, right, as well. You know, I can literally remember the start of, yeah, Fix and Fog doing a, yeah, few jars, exactly, out of a out of a window.
They have scaled up and yeah. they've managed to scale up really well.
Yeah.
But they're also still a local business.
Yeah.
We use a local jam maker who we met at the Underground Market. He's based out in Wainuiomata. He wins multiple awards for his jams and yeah. marmalades, and he's amazing. I literally go to Moore Wilson's and buy everything from Moore Wilson's. Mm. So everything that we do, we try to keep as local as possible. We try to keep, and not just because of the buzzword, but because we are local and we yeah. want to support the people who are around us, and we want to support the other small businesses, because frankly, there's not enough business for all of us
yeah.
that we have to work together and we have to have this community. Yeah. And I am somebody who loves community. And maybe that's because I've come here from another country. And so I don't really have my own community. So I've yeah. had to create one and find, you know, places where I can belong. But all of this will drive the price up. And so we do our costing. We look at how much it actually costs. We add our profit margin, which will include, well, to a certain extent, labor. We add our GST, and then we look at the market. So we initially were selling the brownies for $4.50 each,
yep.
because standard brownie that you would buy anywhere else, which is twice as big as ours and made with much lesser ingredients, mm. is about $3 to $4.
Yep.
And so the most that we could push our particular product too for a single brownie, even though it has all of this work and all of this time and all of these lovely ingredients, was $5
yeah.
or $5.50 to include our packaging.
Which from a percentage point of view is not a lot. And speaking of GST there, I think that's one other thing. Anyone that does understand GST, how it works, it does carry forward. But the big thing for the hospitality industry, and especially anyone producing anything, is it's not part of wages. Right. Mm. So if your labor costs are high, your GST bill is going to be high at the end of, you know, 20th mm-hmm. of every month, or not 20th of every month, 2 months, 6 months, yeah. depending how you do your accounting. I've had customers before go, oh, you get all your GST back. And it's just not the reality. You know, we mm. operate on over 40% wage costs,
mm.
which is high,
mm.
but we value people and give them as much of the take as we can.
Yeah.
Which does mean that, yeah, our GST at the end of the month is going to be quite a high
yeah.
bill. People still think the general idea of, you know, a third wage costs or even less is,
yeah, it's outrageous.
Is normal.
how would you even do that?
Yeah, exactly. It would be amazing. Yeah, speaking of costs, I mean, the other side of costs that probably doesn't come across is all the overheads, the things yeah. that you don't think about: gas, power, insurance. You know, we pay crazy amounts of insurance, and mm. Wellington's insurances in general have gone up so much with earthquakes and all those bits and pieces. Yeah, have you got any sort of insights into that you can sort of let people know about how much of what they're paying for is actually going towards a whole lot of other things other than you driving around in a Merc and living yeah. a luxury lifestyle?
Man, can you imagine that? If we all just had like these super fancy cars rolling around Wellington, like, yeah, we're in hospo. That is outrageous. Yeah, so the interesting thing about our particular spot where we are is because it's up some stairs, our rent is significantly lower than mm-hmm. if we were on the ground floor. And this is something that I think and talk about all the time, because I look across the road and I see Swimsuit, and Swimsuit are just constantly packed with people and our shop is empty. And I'm always like, oh, if we were on the ground floor, maybe we would just have so many more people coming in because people would just walk by. And my husband always goes, yeah, but do you remember when you were looking at shops on the ground floor yeah, nice and the rent was like triple your rent? But, you know, at the same time, we've got rent. We've got rent to pay. We've got insurance to pay. We've got electricity bills. We have all of these things, staff costs. We have all of this stuff that adds up and takes away from the rest of your business. So then when it comes to the 20th of the month, you have like, you know, $3,000 to $4,000 in a small business mm. that you have to pay to all of these just suppliers yeah. of to keep your business
and
running.
And the things people like, napkins and random bits and pieces oh, yeah. and things like that, that they add up so quickly.
Yeah. And then also I still do all of our laundry.
Yeah.
So, you know, 2-3 times a week, I'm taking home bags of mm-hmm. laundry and doing them at home and then washing them, drying them to get them back in. Sometimes if I don't have time to dry them, I put them in the oven to dry them because the oven's already on
yeah.
and I don't have time at home to wait for 2 hours for it to dry.
Yeah, I think we do need to really, you know, get that message across more and more in the hospitality industry, and I'm sure there's other industries, of what goes into the cost, you know, what you're actually paying for.
Yeah, we are, you know, we as business owners are swallowing so many costs mm. to give you a product that is affordable. And so then it is incredibly depressing to make you know, 30 sonuts on a Saturday and have like 10 left over at the end of the day.
And I mean, the sonuts are a real labor of love. There's going to be a video going up soon that you can check out social media channels to check out. It actually shows how much work goes into those and the time it takes and why they cost what they do. And in fact, they should probably cost more. So we've been talking about costs and all sorts of things. Obviously, we've got minimum wage going up again, 1st of April and again next year. I've been in business, it's over 6 or 7 years, and every one of those years, apart from one, that wage has increased. From my perspective, and again, I think it's a misunderstanding, it's not because we're paying everyone minimum wage that this affects us, as you want to keep everyone's wages increasing across the board, but every delivery driver, every farmer, every supplier, every producer across the board, it's affecting them as well. So it doesn't just affect our labour costs, it affects food costs, it affects everything. How's that going to affect you?
To be honest, I think it is a huge oversight on the government's part for small business, because it's a really difficult thing, and it's super controversial, because obviously we do not want to pay people a shit wage. We have people who work for us, and particularly for me, all the girls who work for me are super passionate about it, and they are amazing, and I have this brilliant little team, and I want to reward them for their work with, you know, the right pay increases and promotions and all the rest of that. And the problem is, as soon as you start to increase the minimum wage, you cannot, as a small business, continue to offer an affordable price range for your customers, because you have to increase everything. So for, you know, currently the wage is $17.60, and that's going to go up in April to $18.90, and then go up next April to $20. As a small business, you that means that you just can't afford to have people.
Yeah.
Because you can't pay people. And equally, how can you pay somebody who has no experience $20 and pay your CDP the same amount?
That's the thing that really...
You have to scale it.
Yeah, that's the thing that really gets me, is that it's not the ones that are coming in early on that are missing out. It's people with experience, it's people with skills, it's people that have been doing this and are trying to make a profession out of it, who haven't been able to have the same sort of fiscal benefits over the last 5, 6, 7 years that in a different climate they would have. And the other thing that, you know, seems to not being acknowledged around this is the people earning minimum wage don't seem to be any better off.
No,
And that concerns me. And look, I don't know the politics of it or the economics of it in depth enough, but just that's a visual thing from speaking to my staff, from, you know, seeing where they're at in their lives, is they're not better off. And that's really unfortunate. And I don't know a way around that. But yeah, have you looked into the potential industry standards that are being looked at for hospitality at all? Or?
Not really, no. I'll tell you a secret. I'm winging it every day, Asha. I just wait for people to tell me you should be doing this thing, and then I do it.
Fair enough.
There's so much stuff on my plate that with many things you end up just having to kind of go as you go. And especially for us, because we are a baby business. And I am figuring out a lot of things. I really kind of wish that, I mean, some people are going to be like, well, if you wish that you had this, you should have gone to business school. But I kind of wish that somebody just gave me a manual of like how to run a business.
I've done some business papers before, and like a lot of it was irrelevant, especially because of the hospitality operates so differently.
It's so erratic.
Well, not only is it so erratic that, like I said before, like we were talking before about, you know, not being able to pay yourself, and so that's a bad business plan. That's what a business degree would tell you. Just don't do it.
Yeah.
You know, like honestly, you could get rid of 80% of restaurants.
Yeah.
If you were going to operate under normal business criteria, and that's because the margins that we operate under are lower than pretty much anyone at profit margins are lower than what would be recommended to go into business for. It does tend to be a passion project and things like that. There are people that do well out of hospitality, and there are ways to make money out of it. But, you know, the reality is for people that are doing it, especially I look at someone like Lashings, who, you know, the work that you've even put into things like the reusable cups and, you know, local suppliers and all that sort of, those are all costs that don't have as much perceived value to the consumer as they should.
And you know, the thing about the reusable cups is people obviously think that we're just like taking this money and then sitting on this like yeah. hoard of reusable cup money. We literally make nothing from the cups.
Yeah.
What happens is people pay the $3, and if they return the cup to us, we give the money back.
Yep.
And if they don't return the cup to us, we have to buy another cup.
Yeah.
So people think like we are just like raking in all this money and we literally are making nothing on it. It's because we have made a commitment as a business to be more environmentally friendly. Mm. And that's something that I have decided I want to do. Because yeah. when I started Lashings, I said, I want a business that is affordable. I want one that is environmentally sustainable. And I want one that can give back.
Yeah.
And I want to be a local business that can be in someone's home and they can go, this company are doing good things and I want to support them. So those were my criteria when I started the business, which is a little bit kind of airy-fairy, like, woo, let's make the world a wonderful place. But that's kind of what I wanted.
Yeah.
I read this thing ages ago. It was actually when people were discussing the minimum wage going up, and there was a Stuff article and there were a bunch of comments underneath, and did the stupid thing of reading the comments.
I always read comments.
No, everyone's always like, don't read the comments. I'm like, no, I want to read the comments because I need to know what people are saying because it's lols.
Yeah.
But something that this person had said was, and I've heard this in a couple of different places, it is the most selfish thing in the world to wake up one day and decide that you want a business just because you want a business.
Mm.
And that is something that kind of sticks in my head all the time. Somebody had said as well, in this minimum wage conversation, they had said, if you can't afford to not be paying your staff $20 an hour, then you shouldn't have a business.
Yeah. I hear that all the time.
Yeah.
All the time. That's the one that I hear all the time. And my response to that is, well, if you can't afford to be paying 25% more than what you currently are anytime you go out, you shouldn't be allowed to go out.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's not restaurateurs, business owners, whatever, that are raking it in.
Yeah.
The consumers are the ones that are getting the discounted food at the moment.
Yeah.
That's the reality. I sound like a dickhead restaurant owner in saying that, but we could all open up our books and you'd quickly see that that is actually the case.
Yeah.
Something that I think feeds on from this and something that me and you share in common is being on Sick Leave podcast with Sean.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic podcast. Please check it out. Sick Leave, search for it on however you listen to your podcasts, and you'll find some amazing content on there and some amazing people who have been on there and shared their story. I thought maybe give us a quick chance to just talk about how, you know, you deal with your sort of mental and physical health with such a demanding way that you run your business. You know, it's all on you. Like, there's a lot of weight on your shoulder, and how you kind of get by with it. I'm sure you get lots of support from your husband and your staff.
Yeah.
But any advice for people who maybe feel like they're, whether it's a breaking point or just feeling this extreme weight on them, how to kind of cope with those situations?
So something that I have been going through recently is because there's so many changes and so much negative stuff that's been happening recently, and I've been having to make so many decisions that I'm just decision burnt out.
Yep.
I don't want to go home and decide what I want to eat for dinner. I just want to go home and shove something in my face and fall asleep, which my husband's very good at. He's he's very good at just having food ready, but I had to tell him last night that I cannot make any decisions for the foreseeable future. He just needs to roll with it and just be ready to be ready to just put me to bed. But something that I did yesterday was I actually just did a little Facebook post to my friends, and I said, I am incredibly burnt out. I am very grumpy. I'm very tired and I need some help. And I said, actually, something I said is I just need people to say nice things about me and my business at the moment, because I'm feeling like everything I touch turns to shit.
Yeah.
And I have had so many of my friends message me to tell me that things that they do to help them when they're feeling low. I've had people sending me helpful things that they read or recommendations for things. And I've actually had so many people reaching out to me. It's been a bit overwhelming, and I haven't really been able to respond to all of them because I said, I'm having difficulty responding to people right now. And then they all messaged me.
Yeah.
But that is a huge part of when you're feeling low, when you're feeling down. It is actually not keeping it in yourself, because that's the worst thing you can do. The worst thing you can do is just hold on to everything and then just fester. And all you do is you just go over round and round in your head continuously. And being able to put it out there and just say, hey, I'm struggling.
Yeah.
You would be surprised at how many people actually will want to help or want to be on your side or want to help pull you out of it. On a side note, because obviously a lot of my mental health stuff is tied to my physical well-being and my physical health. At the end of Sean's podcast, I had talked about how I was having some further testing done. So this is probably an okay place to now say that the second half of the testing has been done. Mm-hmm. I was having some extremely high blood pressure stuff going on. I haven't really talked about this a lot. So I was having some extreme high blood pressure stuff going on. I'm currently waiting for a CT scan from the hospital because they think I might have a tumor.
Yeah.
So that's been pretty shitty to deal with, but also they're not urgently rushing me through. Sorry.
Take your time. You...
Yeah, they're not urgently rushing me through because my blood pressure is currently managed by two different medications, and they think that probably the tumor is likely benign, mm-hmm. if it's even there. So I've got to wait for some imaging, and if the imaging comes back positive, then they're just going to send me straight for surgery.
Yeah.
But I have been waiting since October, November now for this because there was a strike at the hospital, and so everything got pushed back a little bit. So that's another thing. You don't really know the person that you're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And when people come in and can be pretty shitty to the person who's serving them, you have no idea that they are having conversations about buying houses, having children, and potentially having a tumor.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. That's not easy. And we really appreciate you feeling open enough to be able to talk about these things. And I think that is an incredible point to make is, you know, at the end of the day, any business or any food business, whatever it is, it's just people.
Yeah.
Like everything is just people.
Yeah. And I think everyone forgets that.
Yeah, hugely. And like, I know restaurants are often places where people go to escape and to get away from things. That doesn't mean that there's any right to unload on staff or pass those problems on, because the people serving you are people too.
Yeah.
And just as likely to be having a bad day as you are.
I have had multiple conversations about how there's this weird thing that happens when people go into a hospitality business where they just kind of turn their brain off and they forget how to read anything. They forget how to talk to anyone, and they're incredibly rude and impatient.
Yeah.
And I always kind of want to be like, where do you work? Shall I come into your work and belittle you in front of all of your coworkers? How would that make you feel?
Mm.
But as a business owner, you can't do that. You just smile and you take the shit.
Yeah. It is one of the big issues within, I'm going to make this broader, of service industry. So, you know, I kind of include any sort of retail and other services providers within that, is I think there's something that switches in people's heads of service servant.
Yes,
this
absolutely.
This person is less than me because they're serving me.
The worst job I ever had, I worked in a baby shop where it was a boutique baby shop where we sold things like baby Christian Dior and baby Ralph Lauren. And
the
really important stuff. Yeah, like the Swarovski crusted dummy, like stuff like that.
And I know a few diamond crusted dummies.
So it was the worst job I ever had because I was a university graduate. I had graduated from a very good university. I was literally working there because it was post-university finding a job. And so it was a part-time job that became full-time because everyone else went back to university. And I ended up becoming the manager. And people would come in and they would treat me like I was really stupid and I had no education and I was not even worth their time or looking at, and they would get so impatient. We would gift wrap things for them, and it was like a cellophane gift wrap that just was so difficult to wrap around things, because you wrap it in tissue paper and then you had to wrap it in cellophane. And I just remember this one woman who stood there and was just like, I'm just gonna do it myself, just give it to me and I'll just do it myself. And I was like, whoa, lady, do you want to just calm down for a minute? And you would have people who came through and just treated you like shit.
Yeah.
Retail is terrible. People are horrible. They can't, you get, and the thing is, you get 90% of people who are amazing.
Yeah.
But then you have 10% of people who treat you like you are worse than a piece of dog shit on their shoe. and you
and unfortunately those they're, people stick to you
that yeah
like the piece of dog
exactly,
shit on your shoe.
Exactly,
like,
yeah, I mean, what a great analogy. Yeah. Yeah, they are the ones that are the shards in your heart.
Yeah. Have you got anything else you want to talk about?
Probably not.
Okay.
We've covered quite a bit.
Yeah, we have. And can we like finish on something positive?
Yes.
And that's where can people find Lashings or get Lashings products or come and see you and give you a smile and say thank you for what you do?
I mean, if anyone wants to come and give me a hug, I'm like 100% open to that. I would love that. You can come and find us in Lashings HQ, which is on the corner of Eva and Dixon Street above Eva Beaver. You'll find the entrance on Eva Street. It's got a nice big green bit of wall, so just come through there and up the stairs. As you heard earlier, I'm pretty much there all the time. You can also buy the brownies in Newell Thorndon. You can buy it at the Metro on Willis, Newell. There's a couple more places where we're probably going to be stocked soon, so just keep an eye on our Instagram and our Facebook for that. You can also find us until the 14th of March at the Underground Market. That is the last ever market. Please come and support not just us, but all of the amazing makers and bakers and creators who are down there. There's about 60 to 100 stallholders who would love your support. And on a Sunday, as long as the weather's good, you'll find us at the Harbourside Market from 8 a.m. until 2 p.m.
All right, Jackie, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you and to get some of these topics that I think are really important to get out there.
So thank you.
Thanks for taking the time to listen to us today. Check out honeycomb.co.nz for information and links relating to this episode. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast so you'll never miss an episode.